completely redesigned Bashani Radio app is hotter than ever. Ever. Now you can binge listen your favorite podcast show. And for those listeners that like to talk trash, excuse me, I mean give feedback. Just tap our new feedback button and run your mouth for 60 seconds. Download free for iPhone and Android in the App Store or listen online at BashaniRadio.com.
To the Patrice Brantley Show, where helping others is the name of the game. And on this show, we push purpose, positivity, and personal growth. Today, we will be speaking with two trailblazers in the area of mental health with the DOC. Hello, y'all. I'm excited about this. We're going to be talking to Ms. Rhonda Champagne and to Mr. Michael Johnson, who will be sharing with us today their new book, their viewpoints on correcting treatment in corrections. And in my words, truly disturbing the norm. Welcome, guys.
Well, thank you, Patrice, for having us. So excited to be here.
Yes, thank you for having us.
I'm so overjoyed to have y'all. So this is wonderful. I love this. Y'all hear me saying disturbing the noise, disturbing the norm. I am that person who believes in shaking up the establishment. And guess what? I have two families who have done it today. So I'm going to go back a little bit. Tell me what's your stories. Give me a little taste of you.
Go ahead, Rhonda. Ladies first.
Okay. Well, what I would tell you is that, I was born in a small town, raised in a small town, had an alcoholic father. So there was, there was some abuse and some neglect going on early in childhood. So I've had my own trauma. And I think that just kind of what provoked me to be in the field, right? So I got my degree, went to the mental health center with my bachelor's degree, started working there, and then later decided that I would go and get my master's. And I've loved the mental health field my whole life. I've been in it. And then in 2015, the Department of Corrections hired me to help assist a team in implementing a trauma-informed treatment program for incarcerated women. And so that's where I met Mr. Johnson.
All right, so now that you've met Mr. Johnson, can we meet Mr. Johnson? There we go. So,
of course.
What's your story?
My name is Michael Johnson. I'm a former lieutenant for the Montana Department of Corrections, resigned in January 2020. I've worked with incarcerated populations from the age of 13 to 90 years old of both genders, went through a number of different programs of treatment centers, again, for incarcerated populations. Met Rhonda when the Montana Department of Corrections tasked us with developing a trauma-informed treatment center for a population of adult women incarcerated. Research-based studies showed that criminal behavior and addictions, there's a great underlining foundation of past trauma. And by treating the past trauma, you can better reintegrate people into the community and address, criminal behaviors and addictions. What took off right off the bat was myself as a lieutenant, my job is to uphold policies and procedures, which I don't necessarily write. They are tasked on me. For safety and security reasons. And then Rhonda comes in with her treatment culture and it clashed, to say the least. It was like oil and water. Everything she wanted to do was a danger or a risk to a safety or security measure, as I was trained and my officers were trained. But we embarked on this expedition and it was very successful. It took a long time, years, to kind of come together and really develop. But we were ultimately able to uphold a safe and secure environment without doing things like strip searches. Strip searches were hugely an issue for Rhonda and her treatment culture. But from a DOC security side, they're absolutely necessary to save lives. We were able to still, without doing strip searches, maintain a safe and secure environment. I don't want to talk too much before inviting Rhonda back into it, but excited about sharing other aspects of the program that we did. What we did was so unique and so different and so really outside of the power and control approach that the Department of Corrections typically has. It was really interesting to see it become so successful. It changed my life. It changed my outlook on the women that were in the program. And I stopped asking myself, why did they, you know, break this law? And I started asking myself, my gosh, learning what they went through in their childhood and stuff, it's no wonder.
It kind of gave you a shift from not just seeing the crime, but seeing the human or the woman at that moment.
Absolutely. And seeing that those women as heroes, really, and incredibly strong, strong women that were taking on things that happened to them. And I just admired every single one of them.
And, you know, if I could.
Oh, go ahead, Ms. Rhonda.
If I could jump in here and say, I came into the Department of Corrections and the trauma-informed treatment program with my own biases too. I mean, my dealings with probation officers and police officers prior to that, the power and control that's expressed in interactions has always left me kind of off-put from security, right? So when we get into the treatment program and, you know, I kept questioning myself, why am I even trying this? Because, you know, the cultures are just so vastly different. But that's when I really started seeing my own biases and dropping my preconception of what a police officer or a guard or who they are too. They are very good people doing what they're trained to do. The problem with our system is, in my opinion, the training, because the very first training that I went to while at the Department of Corrections, and Michael can verify this, I was absolutely stunned and shocked that this was a training. You know, I'm like, they're teaching all of these people to not trust the inmate, to look at them they're going to manipulate you, they're going to harm you, don't make eye contact with them, and don't communicate with them. Right. And I'm like, what are we doing? Because this is a treatment facility. You cannot not connect with people and see them for who they are as a human being and expect to have treatment done. We can't look at them like they're a mass, you know, major criminal out there and expect to make a connection and to work on really personal, interpersonal issues. So there was a clash right from the beginning. But what I realized and what I would like to say later is that the group of people, the officers, they're good people. They're wanting to make a difference in people's lives too. And the outside policies and procedures really are a hindrance to that treatment.
What I hear for what you're both saying to me is that it's not just the officers. I think for a lot of people, they just assume officers in any form, it's just, they're the problem. It sounds like it's a structural thing, how they're being trained, what they're being told, and the viewpoint or the lens that they're kind of looking through.
Exactly.
And you're absolutely right.
It's interesting to me because as I'm hearing this, I'm hearing trainings. And I know for me being in the field fairly couple of years, I would say about 10. For me, training is very different because some places that you go, it's very, you know, make it about the client, you know, touchy-feely, depending on what your particular population is. And then when I was working with young men and young women who were coming out of this system, it was very, be very standoffish, be very distant. And I'm like, how can we really connect with them? So I agree exactly with you, Ms. Rhonda, and I agree with you, Mr. Johnson, that it is such a big thing to have that connection. And instead of creating a wall, building a bridge so that you can actually make a change.
Right.
So
that's beautifully said.
Sometimes to do that, you got to get through that initial clash. And so we were, you know, just give you the example of the strip search. We were all sitting around a planning, you know, we're sitting around a table. There was a dozen or so of us planning what this treatment program would look like. And our superintendent, you know, was going through the process and he said, well, the women will come from the prison system. They'll be, you know, in the orange suits. They'll be chained, you know, handcuffed and probably their feet chained and that kind of stuff. And I am like, what, you know? So when they come in, you know, we'll take them over to the unit and we'll start an unclothed search is what they called it. Right. And I'm like, what, wait a minute, is an unclothed search a strip search? Mm-hmm. And I can remember the superintendent saying, well, we don't call it that because that's offensive. And I'm like, well, so then what's different? You know, he said, now we call it an unclothed search. Well, nothing. The policy, you know, the procedure is still the same. We just don't call it a strip search because people find it offensive. And I'm like, because it is offensive, right? You can't start off a treatment program. I just said, I can't be a part of that. And the mindset at the time, well, and Mr. Johnson or Michael, you can describe the mindset at that time.
Okay. So I want to backtrack just a little bit, if I may. Yes. We wrote a book. We wrote a book about this experience. We felt really compelled to be able to communicate to the reader and let them follow along as the lieutenant, you know, debates and justifies and defends the safety and security policies and procedures, as well then as the therapist, and she's defending this treatment environment, because Department of Corrections is mixing treatment and they need to. That is their goal, is to, it's called the Department of Corrections, right? It's about correcting right. behavior. And so treatment is absolutely necessary, but what we really are advocating for is that as the department mixes treatment, what they're doing is they're building treatment centers, just like prisons, with locked yes. doors, fences, and barbed wires. And then they're operating these treatment centers under prison policies and procedures, oftentimes the exact same kind of procedures for like the high side or most dangerous part of the penitentiary. This is the problem. You can't do both. And what you really end up with is a treatment center. Well, you have a prison with a treatment center sign out front, and then a couple of LACs or therapists on payroll that meet with these people once a week or have groups, and they're calling that treatment. But there's this whole other level of treatment that should involve the correctional officers. That's what we did here. We made our correctional officers correctional counselors, and we focused on a relationship-based rapport. So my correctional counselors were facilitating groups. They were having things like gratitude group circle with them, and they got to know them, and it really broke down that barrier, and really it implemented a higher level of security. But in the beginning, back to the strip search issue, I was absolutely against it. She was saying, we can't strip search these people. I said, the heck we can't. They're coming from prison. They're going to have weapons and drugs and whatever else they're going to have on them. And we need to do this. And I tried to tell her, not just to keep them safe and my officers safe, but you safe. Well, what we learned, even though it was a heck of a kind of an argument for a long time, we foregoed it and we didn't do the strip search, but we just kind of told them, look, if you have anything on you, drop it now, put it in the trash can. You won't be consequenced for it. What that did was that started the relationship off with a level of trust that an incarcerated person has never known before, because every incarcerated person knows the first thing that happens is you have to take your clothes off and do, basically, if you really wanted to think about it, the strip search itself, and I didn't always believe this, but it's a sex crime. Mm-hmm. If a civilian were to do a strip search on another civilian, they would be charged with a felony sex crime. But then our departments and our institutions are now saying, no, this is just being professional and this is being safe. And it's even further more frustrating because we have the technology now. You know, we don't need to be making people strip down in front of strangers and open themselves up. And it's uncalled for, it's outdated. And Rhonda really advocated and pushed for this. And I think
it's my take on it. Patrice, was that, you know, if you start off a trauma treatment program by strip searching somebody, you're actually traumatizing them before we even start.
And you could further argue too, I like to argue that, you know, the strip search is oftentimes defended by saying, well, this is how we keep drugs out of the facility. But you know, I think the real fact is the mass majority of drugs implementing any kind of correctional institution is coming in through the staff, mass majority of it. So if you really wanted to say, well, the strip search is the way you got to get the drugs out of the prison, well, then you want to strip search everybody from the warden to the maintenance man. And, oh, no, we're not going to do that. That would be criminal. You know, it's time to get rid of it. And you know, we did it, and those women respected it so much. We did random drug tests. No one ever came up hot for a drug. There were no weapons found. No one got assaulted. It was amazing. Just that one little detail.
Not to counteract what Michael's saying, because he's exactly right. That was the start of the building of the trust. Mm-hmm. But where it really developed and where it really connected and implemented was with the correctional counselors.
Wait a minute. You all keep using this term, and I hate to jump in here, but this is so good to me. I'm having a time holding myself. You spoke about it, and Michael did as well. He spoke about the correctional officer and the correctional counselor. Can I get one of you all to break that down for the listeners, please? And for me.
Well, from my perspective, from the treatment perspective, and watching Lieutenant Johnson model and train his staff underneath him, the difference between historically correctional officers kind of stand back in the room, they watch everybody intently, they watch for things to be happening, and they're ready to pounce and make sure whatever that the environment is safe. A correctional counselor actually did groups with the women. Everything that was implemented as part of the treatment program, the lieutenant and his office, his counselors sat in and did. We had a recreation thing, and the staff there, the counselors, did the recreation with the women. When we talk about gratitude circle, it was the first thing that we did in the morning, and we did it again on the second shift. But everybody got into a circle and they would talk about certain things that they were grateful for, including the correctional counselors. So an officer, you know, was more like, it's a hierarchy. I'm watching you in case your behavior goes wrong. But a counselor is like, we're here together. Let's talk about what we are grateful for. I'm grateful for this, you know, and Lieutenant Johnson can tell you what he learned watching that process through both his officers and the women, the residents, inmates, but we called them residents there. What they experienced through those gratitude circles was a tight connection and bond and respect and trust.
So, we were called correctional counselors. I was called a unit supervisor, and then the sergeants were shift supervisors. The problem with the whole system is we were titled those things, but when they sent us to training, the four-week training that everybody goes to when they first get hired, it's correctional detention officer basic training. And you are trained on how to be an officer. The fact is there is no written training to be a correctional counselor. It's similar to calling a strip search, an unclosed search. Give it a nicer name, but if your training doesn't match the name, if there's no difference in the procedure, and that was the problem. So, but what we did is we were a pilot project. And even though we went to these trainings and my officers would come back and they'd say, wait, we just had the inmate manipulation training and that teaches us to keep our distance, watch our boundaries. And basically, you know, they're lying if their lips are moving. Whereas the treatment, treatment culture, this relationship-based rapport correctional counselor title, which didn't have any written training to go with it, wants us to open up relationship with them and trust. So the really amazing thing about Riverside is that we kind of went our own way. We tried something new. And I think so that's some of the reason we got shut down too. But the fact was, I saw it work. I saw the correctional counselors develop their own relationships with the women. I ate with the women, and they usually ate with the women. We did recreation with the women, weight training and yoga and playing softball and basketball. We conducted on facility, on the unit groups. Because remember, treatment, usually if there's a therapist, she works Monday through Friday. You know, don't forget there's a whole weekend and there's meetings and all this is taking place. And you can't just have treatment for 8 hours a day. This was a really embodied kind of treatment culture. And what I found was pretty soon I heard at Gratitude Circle, a resident, we call them residents, studying names, resident be grateful for an officer. And then I heard an officer be grateful for a resident.
Okay, that's a major breakthrough right now. Because I have never heard anyone say they're grateful for their correctional officer or counselor. So I got to tell you, that to me is an amazing moment. You talked about a lot of the challenges with the trust in the building, but it sounds like those became your biggest aha, woohoo, like we made it moments at the end.
Absolutely. Those relationships actually founded the highest level of security we could ever ask for. Far more than a power and control. If you break a rule, I'm going to consequence you. And they did get consequence. We had rules, you had write-ups, but you know, that relationship provided more security than the strip search I think ever did. Because we know the strip searches, they still get stuff passed. It's not a foolproof thing, but.
And you know, when we developed the program, Ms. Patrice, what we did is we developed a 24/7 program, a body, mind, spirit program, holistic program. So we addressed things that were, you know, the body. I mean, we took women who had been sitting incarcerated for 14 and 16 and 18 months or longer, right? And we would bring them out. So at one point, I can remember going to our nurse and saying, you know, all these women look pregnant to me. Are they pregnant? You know, I was worried about like, how long are they going to be in here? And are they going to have, these babies? And none of them were. It's the food and the inability to move, your body while you're sitting in jail, you know. And so women, you know, gained a bunch of weight. And we know that's going to affect the self-esteem and their body image and that type of stuff. So we built in a physical fitness. We had a physical fitness teacher who was amazing. All the staff there were absolutely amazing, but, you know, that did programs with the women. And when the women started feeling better and they start seeing the weight come off and getting more tone and those type of things, and they were treated as a human being with dignity and respect, right? And that's the key there. You don't look at them and start treating them right off the bat as if they're a terrible person. We need to know that we have a safe environment. And when you talk about some of the basic things that you need in order to develop good trauma treatment, the top one is safety. But it means physically safe. A person has to feel physically safe in their environment, but they also have to feel psychologically safe. And in most incarcerated places, you're not going to feel psychologically safe because you're going to get in trouble for anything. You know, I think because we were a pilot project, we didn't have to follow those tight, strict procedures and policies. And so we went outside of it a little bit. And our program was a 24-hour program that encompassed things that treatment modalities that addressed the physical body, the psychological body, the mental strain and stress that trauma brings on, the emotional aspects of it, and the spiritual aspects of who am I and what am I about and what do I want to do with my life, right? So it was a 24-hour program, not just like, all right, we have a treatment thing. You're going to go to treatment for 2 hours twice a week and be done and call that treatment. It was a culture within the whole facility that was about treatment. And like I said, they had gratitude circle and practicing positive. And I mean, just a whole bunch of things that were going on all the time. And they had periods of rest and meditation. And, you know, it was a very safe environment for you to be yourself and address those things that cause you problems.
I'm going to jump in for a second. You said something that really hit me. You said a couple things that really hit me, but I want to kind of hone in on this. You said you learned that these were not terrible people. And I feel like people automatically assume that anytime you dealt with any type of legal system that, oh my God, this is a bad person, they're terrible. I don't believe that. I don't believe anyone is terrible or bad. I do believe that there are people who've made bad decisions or not made positive decisions that were going to benefit their life, or they felt that was the only option at the time. So I thought that was a great piece that you brought up. And I also want to go a little deeper. You talked about that 24 hours, you know, and I love how Mr. Michael talked about having treatment only 8 hours doesn't do enough when it's what we see for the legal piece. I'm just going to jump on in. What we see in that legal piece is just the symptom, the ending of what was from years and years ago, a trauma. And I love that because you all talked about that. Was there a particular trauma that stood out the most with your population?
Well, and what I would say is we did the ACE assessment, adverse childhood experiences. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but we did that on the women there and the average score was a 9. Right. That only goes to 10. Right. And the most of the women there had an average score of 9, meaning they had witnessed, you know, they had endured physical or emotional or neglect abuse. They had witnessed their primary caregiver getting beat up. There were people who were incarcerated that were important to them in their life. There was just a ton of different childhood traumas that came boiling up to the surface. And what happens when you're traumatized and what goes on with your body, the feeling is so uncomfortable, right? The trigger response on the nervous system. And it's so uncomfortable that you can't expect people to just endure that and move on. They're going to shut that feeling down. And unfortunately, drugs will do it just super quick. And so a lot of people with trauma will self-medicate through alcohol or street drugs or, you know, even overusing prescription drugs or whatever it is, right? But they're trying to calm that nervous system down. And then obviously that leads to addiction, and then addiction leads to crime, and then people get back incarcerated. So you see this continual revolving door within the Department of Corrections. And until you can really address the trauma and let people know this thing happened to me, but that's not who I am, right? I'm not, you know, so many of the women, I mean, when you read the book, there are very personal stories in there that talk about the women's trauma. You also at the end see, you know, in the book, the women themselves, there's over 30 women who wrote their own testimony about what this program did. Now, for me, in my experience, I've never worked with people in my private practice who come out of incarceration saying, I wished I could go back into that program. We had a bittersweet population. I mean, they were so excited to leave, but they were sad to leave too, because it was such a safe network there. Many of them made lifelong friends and they're doing awesome. But I would encourage everybody to read their stories, read their testimony, because it to me, that's where the road is paved, is how effective the program was.
I love how you're actually sharing the book, the actual testimonies. I think that's a beautiful thing for people to see, that this was not just you going in and shaking up the norm, but that shakeup actually worked. And I think for so many people are so big in the society of, well, we've always done it that way. And as we clearly see now in this COVID day and time, things have totally changed. And what may have worked in your mom and your dad's day definitely wouldn't work now. And I love that you all did something that just not just made a difference for those young ladies, but hearing the experience from your own ears, sounds like it made a change for you all as well. So we're gonna wrap up, because I'm telling you, y'all give me some good stuff. So y'all gotta give me a really good last word and then give us the book name again so we can run on out and purchase this book.
Hello? The book is called Correcting Treatment in Corrections. You can get it on Amazon or any bookstore, they can order it. There's a quote that I'm not going to get quite right, but it's by James Baldwin. You write in order to change the world, knowing perfectly well you probably can't, but also knowing that literature is indispensable. And if you can alter a person's reality, even by a millimeter, then you can change it. That quote's in the book, and I is one of the things I thought about a lot. This really is about educating. The whole program that we did is in the book, and the dialogue between the therapist and lieutenant, it's open for a person to come to their own conclusion. And it's not just our opinions. There's other staff members in those testimonies. They saw, one of them referred to it as Camelot, you know, something different. So it is a special book, and I think a lot of people are going to enjoy it and be able to use it.
All right, well, listen, you can't say it any better than that, y'all. Make sure y'all grab this book. Make sure y'all check it out on Amazon. Well, y'all know how this goes. This is Patrice from the Patrice Brantley Show. I want to thank y'all for tuning on in today, where helping others is the name of the game, and where we push positivity, purpose, and personal growth. Make sure you stop by the website, patricebrantley.com, to check out all things new that's going on in the world that can benefit you. You all have an amazing day. And I'll see you soon.
Completely redesigned, Bashani Radio app is hotter than ever. Ever. Now you can binge listen your favorite podcast show. And for those listeners that like to talk trash, excuse me, I mean give feedback. Just tap our new feedback button and run your mouth for 60 seconds. Download free for iPhone and Android in the App Store or listen online at BashaniRadio.com.